your background, beginning with just a little bit about where your parents came from and where you were born, and then getting into your...
I was born in the Shenandoah Valley, Virginia, on a big farm, which was deeded from Lord Fairfax. And my family came there in 1812. The sixth generation of the family lives there now.
Where did they come from initially? Where did they come from initially, your family?
1812. I've not been able to trace the exact, it was from England, but I think they came to North Carolina, because I know that they came from North Carolina up to Lynchburg, Virginia, and then on up to this place in the Shenandoah Valley, which is about 10 miles from Winchester. That's the section. So that's where we have...
Was that on both sides of your family, or from that, both your mother and father were from that area?
My mother was from across the mountain, and Loudoun County, another town. Her ancestors came from Talbot's in Maryland, and we trace about six or seven lines back to either Maryland, Virginia, or Pennsylvania. And many of them were Quakers who came to Pennsylvania, and there was a Quaker movement down into Virginia. Mm-hmm. And
Were both your parents Quakers?
They were both Quakers, yes.
Oh, well, that's where some of your ideas of women came from, wasn't it?
No, yes, we had no division between boys and girls, women and men.
What year were you born then?
1890.
And were you, what birth order were you?
Oh, I was the oldest of three sisters. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And as you were growing up, what kind of, your father actually farmed?
He farmed, and he just did everything. He had a, it was a community, he had a small community country store, and he was the railroad agent and the postmaster and the freight agent and justice of the peace and a member of the county school board. And the interesting thing is that in those days, people had a variety of possibilities, whereas nowadays they're shunted into one technical line. We need more generalists.
Well, how large was the town itself?
Oh, it wasn't. It was a country district and just a country store place. Mm-hmm. And the country railroad. It was the branch of the B&O Railroad, a valley branch from Harper's Ferry down the valley.
And did your mother work on the how large was the farm itself? Was it a working farm?
Oh, it was 300 acres. Oh, right. Yes. Oh, yes. No, she didn't work on the farm. She had all she could do at home.
What was the crop?
Well, we had a variety of things, wheat and corn, and primarily, I guess, and of course, it was a dairy farm, too, so it was quite varied. And he also had, as many of the early settlers did have, a mill, sawmill and grist mill, mm-hmm. for making flour or whatever, oatmeal and so forth.
Was the
garden,
community?
Of course.
Did your mother maintain the garden, or was that done also?
No, my father did. Well, she worked some in the garden. We did, too. We children did quite a bit in the garden. And we had our own flower gardens, too. And he kept the garden, managed the garden. He built a pipeline from the creek so that he could water the garden. Mm. At one stage, but he had to go all the way over to the sawmill to turn it on, and then all the way back to turn it off.
Was it a Quaker community, or were they among the few Quakers?
Well, there we belonged to the Quaker meeting that was organized there. It was one of the first. It was the first religious organization of any denomination that was organized in that part of the valley, hmm. And it was. It was declared a historic site during the bicentennial, and the women served tea there and so forth, and we belonged to that. And in fact, some of my mother's side, well, some on both sides had been instrumental in starting it.
Hmm.
In 1732 it was organized.
Hmm.
But this was a country community, and of course no cars, so that any time you went any place took a long time.
How far was the school from where you lived?
Our school was the traditional little red schoolhouse, though it wasn't red, country school, with all grades in one room, was about 2 miles from us.
And how many children were in the schoolhouse?
I suppose probably 40 or so from the neighborhood children all around.
What had been your own parents' educational background?
My own parents had, each of them at different times, had gone to Swarthmore College. But they had not had the full four-year course at the college, but they'd both gone there at different times. They didn't meet there. They met some other place. I expect they met in some of the Quaker general meetings, you see. So.
Mm-hmm. What did your mother pursue any sort of career before her marriage, after she went to school?
Well, she had a home. Well, she and her brother kept house, had a farm home. And she also was quite artistic. She did some writing and painting and that type of thing, mm-hmm. and embroidery, and housekeeping, managing the home. And then they were both married, and her brother stayed at that home, and she came over to that.
Tell me, as you were growing up, what was the general sort of climate in the house in terms of reading and attitudes about education?
Oh, we had an excellent library. My grandfather, my mother's father, and my father's father both had good libraries of the books of the days, and the including poetry and, of course, religious books and all that type of thing. So we had good reading opportunity, and I just loved to read. And I started out in the very beginning, lying down flat on my stomach and reading a book when I couldn't even read, but I'm making up the story. I couldn't wait. I could read before I went to school.
What, as you got older, what sorts of books were you most interested in? Do you recall any favorites?
I was always interested in history and, of course, a good deal of poetry. And I majored in English first, and then later in my master's degree was in political science. And I had a good deal of economics and social science and biology and anthropology, mm-hmm. which I loved that, and ancient civilizations.
So you were rather broad reader.
We had the children's books as we grew up. My sisters had the Little Colonel books, but that was just slightly after my childhood, so I had other books earlier. And I don't remember details now, but they were really. Mm-hmm. Of course, fairy stories were always interesting. I remember getting a book of Grimm's Fairy Tales for Christmas. And my mother looked at it, and she thought some of them were much too grim for a child. And she marked the ones I was not to read. And believe it or not, I didn't read them.
Oh, really? Was there...
Of course, fairy tales now are interpreted in psychological terms, very much more interesting.
Was the meeting house and the Quaker community an important
miles,
part of your life?
About 5 miles away from us. Mm-hmm. So it took nearly a couple of hours to get there. But it was quite a center for us and for the other families who belonged, and the friendships that were made in the families. But getting together at different times would be difficult, but we did it sometimes, of course.
Were most of your own friends drawn from that circle?
I think they were. Of course, most of the people in the community where we lived were the Methodists, and we were very friendly with them, too. They were some of our childhood companions as well. And we always looked forward to going to the Methodist Church for their Sunday night play they always had. We enjoyed that. And they were our friends too, all the local people.
As you were growing up, what sorts of expectations and even fantasies did you have about your own future in terms of education and what you were going to do?
Well, I didn't have very much idea at that time, but later I was very interested in English and majored in English, and I was told at that time there was quite a demand. This is what happens. You're told when you go into college there's quite a demand for this field or that field or the other. By the time you get out, there isn't much demand for that. I taught then in a small friend's school in Media, Pennsylvania.
Well, did you always expect to go on to college? Was that always assumed that you would go on to college?
Well, I guess we didn't think about it for quite a while. This school didn't go so far, and the only thing that you could do, there were no buses at that time, school buses, but we could have gone up on the train to Winchester. But there was a small family school that one of my mother's cousins had in Waterford, Virginia, near Leesburg, And I went to that for 2 years, and then I went to the Friends School, George School, which is a Friends boarding school, very well-known mm-hmm. Friends boarding school. I went there for 3 years, and so did my sisters.
I see. So that
and then when I thought of being an English teacher, it was obvious it would be necessary to have college training, and I had a scholarship then to Swarthmore, so that was why I went there.
Oh, I see. So in high schools, or when you were in high schools, when you decided basically
sometime
to become
an
English
school,
teacher?
Sometime in high school, I think, yeah. Uh-huh. Sometime in high school. I don't much remember the detail, but then went on to Swarthmore and had...
What year was that?
Well, my bachelor's degree was 1913. Mm-hmm. And then later, while I was teaching at the University of Virginia, I went on with study and got my master's there in political science later. That was much later, 1924.
Now, after you got your bachelor's degree, you started teaching, though?
Yes, I was teaching for a couple of years, and then I went into the suffrage. I was one of the field secretaries of Mrs. Katz's National American Women's uh-huh. Suffrage Association.
Well, before, I'd like to know more about that. Can you tell me first, in your house, because of the Quaker tradition, was there much talk as you were growing up about women's equality and about suffrage?
No, not very much. Mm-hmm. It was just, we never thought about such mm-hmm. a thing. we were all individuals and with a good deal of freedom in the country living, of course, and with many experiences, practical experiences mm-hmm. that helped in our growing up, helped with the housekeeping. And as we got older, we had a division so that my sister had charge of the house, making the beds and sweeping and all, and I had charge of helping with the cooking 1 week, and then we transferred different weeks for a while, which was good. My other younger sister was several years younger, so she didn't come into that till later in her life.
Tell me how you happened to get involved in the suffrage movement.
Well, I was while I was in teaching in Pennsylvania. That was the year 1915 when they were having the suffrage campaign, and I just became interested as a sort of extracurricular activity in working in the office, and becoming familiar with all of it, and gradually more and more absorbing the reasons for it, and so on and so forth. And then one day the person in the office said, we need somebody to go out to speak tonight. You go for us. It's just a small meeting of a group. I don't know whether it was a club meeting or a community meeting, and I couldn't do anything like that. And she persuaded me, and I was to go with someone else. There was a young man and myself, and we, of course, in those days, trolleys, you could get everywhere by trolley. Nowadays, there are no trolleys, but you can't get anywhere unless you have an automobile. And so we went to this meeting, and it wasn't too difficult because I had absorbed all the information, you know, anyway. And then that sort of grew, and through that period of, I suppose, it must have been several months until election day, and I became very interested in that. And I was not really interested in this school because it was an elementary school, and I wasn't interested. I had a lovely group of children and enjoyed them and their parents and all, and my associates in the teaching, one of my associates who was also a Swarthmore alumna, and I lived in a house with one of the ladies who had rooms for us, So I enjoyed it up to a certain point, and then of course the pay was very small in a school like that, and they also wanted you to sign up very, very early in the spring, you see, so you have no opportunity, so that you did have no opportunity. They didn't do it because they did it for the stability of the school, of course, but I then decided to go into the suffrage work. So
you became basically a field worker in suffrage?
Yes.
Paid by the NWSA?
Yes, National American Women's Suffrage Association. I don't remember. They interviewed me and seemed to be pleased with me, and I don't really remember much about that, whether I went to New York for an interview or just how I got in touch with them.
Up until then, your suffrage work had been mainly in Pennsylvania?
Oh yes, it'd been only in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. It'd been only this volunteer work, you see, and not the fundamental type of having any responsibility, mm-hmm. particularly.
And was that out of the Philadelphia office?
Oh, no. It was right there in this small town where they I was had, teaching, yes.
Then the town had...
Oh, yes. It was a state campaign, and mm-hmm. they had an office in many towns through the state.
And was it one of the women's clubs where the members were also members of the National Association?
No. This was definitely a suffrage... There was a chairman of the suffrage work in, mm-hmm. in the county, mm-hmm. and her assistants, she had one or two assistants, I guess, that were paid in the office. They had a small office, mm-hmm. as just like any other campaign nowadays, mm-hmm. and worked from that through the county. I think that was just a county thing, mainly, although this woman was quite knowledgeable about all the things that were going on through the state, too. I didn't have much contact with her. My contact was more with the secretary there, mm-hmm. who was a very knowledgeable person and kept her fingers on everything that was going on.
Were you one of the younger women involved in that?
Well, I think that we were similar ages as we went into the work.
Because many of the women seem to have been women in their 40s with family and...
Now, they were not the women who were the field secretaries. Mm-hmm. They were the women who worked in their communities, mm-hmm. and cities, you see. Mm-hmm. The field secretaries were, of course, had to be footloose to go into the field.
So you decided then that you wanted to become a field secretary?
No, I decided I wanted to do suffrage work. And that was what they wanted done, you mm-hmm. see. And we started out, a group of several of us started out in the headquarters in Washington, where Mrs. Capp and Dr. Anna Howard Shaw mm-hmm. and the people lived in that headquarters. And we young people who were going out, we didn't know what state or where we were to go, you see, then. And they were planning their program for the winter, and we started out living there, I suppose, for a month or 6 weeks we lived there. It was a thrilling experience because women were coming in and out from all over the United States, these very prominent women who were working, very intelligent, fine mm-hmm. women. Mrs. Maud Wood Park lived mm-hmm. there, and Mrs. Catt and Dr. Shaw, and we had lunch every day with these people, you know, just like people anywhere.
Right. What year was that? Would that have been?
Well, that was in early 1917. Uh-huh. And that was the year of the New York campaign, and then I was sent to New York. I went first to Buffalo and was there for. I went to Buffalo, I suppose, in February and was there until about the latter part of July. Then I was transferred to. Auburn and put in charge of Cayuga County, the whole county, to mm-hmm. work through that with the woman who was the head of the organization, and she was an elderly woman, not particularly mobile and very, very anxious to have the work done, but not too able to do too much herself, rather.
What was the nature of your work, actually?
Well, then we planned the whole campaign and worked with, and New York was very well organized. They had a director who... one of their staff members, one of their, I don't know what her, one of their organization members was in charge of the field people, and she'd send us out a letter about once a week with suggestions and with if there was any new policy arrangement and so on mm-hmm. and so forth. We'd all get these letters which would help us, and of course our job was to go and speak at local groups and women's clubs and form suffrage organizations and get activities going and write publicity for the newspapers and come in contact with newspapers. We did all sorts of things across the board. Mm-hmm. And then they would send the speakers through at different times, and we'd have special meetings for speakers who were traveling through, more prominent people.
And were the local suffrage women basically those who would hostess you? Did you stay with them?
No. I stayed at the YWCA mm-hmm. in Auburn, mm-hmm. and the local women, of course, had the organization, and they depended on us for suggestions and planning and work, and we depended on them and so on and so forth for any knowledgeable things. It was quite a responsible type of thing, and allowed opportunity for any type of imagination that you might have.
Before you went into the field, did you get any sort of training?
Well, you see, this experience at the headquarters was supposed to give us more and more background, and we came closely in touch with the policies of the organization and the types of work that were being done. And as I say, we met all of these people from different states and got an idea of what the situation was in different states and so on and so forth. And the type of work for publicity in papers and elsewhere and so forth, we got a great deal of information.
And were most of the women already fairly accomplished public speakers, or was there any training in public speaking?
No, they could speak.
So
you mean of the field secretaries?
Of the field secretaries,
yes.
Because I know I interviewed a woman who was, one of the things that she did, this was in 1912 in New York, as part of the Harriet Stanton Blatches group.
Oh, yes.
And she trained, what she did was set up a speakers bureau and
trained the women as speakers. I'm sure that was done. I never had much contact. Well, I'd had public speaking in school. And was supposed to know how to speak. I was pretty retired at the time. I guess I got over that.
What sort of...
Another thing that we did was to go into other organizations. If they were having a specially big meeting, we'd ask to have 10 minutes or something on the program. And oftentimes we got good audiences that way that we wouldn't have got otherwise just for a suffrage meeting. Now, and we spoke on the street, too. We went out in cars and spoke on the street at times. We did that in Auburn.
What sort of reception did you get with the street corner speaking particularly?
Oh, we got quite a good reception. Once in a while there'd be hecklers. I remember one meeting, I don't know where it was, that may have been in Auburn too, when a friend of mine who was also interested and was doing some work, but she wasn't doing regular work, came to speak, and she was a very good speaker and a very attractive person, and she was speaking in there were some rowdies in the crowd. I guess the policemen were around. And this man asked her, why don't you stay home and take care of your children, or something like that. You know, that was a usual question. And what about your children? Why don't you stay home? And she said, I will not tell the gentleman how many children I have, but I will say to him that the ones that I have are very well being taken care of at the present moment. She wasn't married. She didn't have any children at all. But she just made that quick response.
Generally, it was by the time of the big campaign in New York, was there a fairly receptive mood to the suffrage movement?
Oh, yes. And there were some of the political party people that were working, too, and were very interested. And, of course, the suffrage organization was working to try to get the party people with them, because they would have influence, you see, through the party. You see, both New York and Pennsylvania had campaigns in 1915 that were not,
that were
defeated. Mm-hmm. And the Constitution of Pennsylvania had a provision that no question that came up and was voted down could be brought up again for a certain number of years. I think it was 5 or 6. But New York had no such provision. So they had another campaign right away in 1917, 2 years later.
Oh, I see. So you worked in the New York campaign until it won then?
Until it won, yes. Mm-hmm.
And then what was the... So you were first in...
Buffalo, and then in Auburn and Cayuga County. Uh-huh. Cayuga County.
So that was what, for
the
about
central part
almost
of the state.
About 6
from
months?
From February until the November election.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened after the November election?
Well, then we all went to New York. Mrs. Catt called in all the people that had been working. We had a meeting in New York and discussion of what next and so on and so forth. They apportioned the different people to other states that were having other campaigns. And I was sent to South Dakota the next year in 1918.
Do you recall how much you were earning as a field secretary?
The first, the beginning earnings was $75 a month. Mm-hmm. But, of course, our expenses were paid, mm-hmm. which was, of course, a very low pay, but it was interesting work, and the expenses paid meant a good deal, too. Mm-hmm. It's been so many years, I forget the details of how it was worked out, but that was the, and probably it was raised later. And then in South Dakota, I had charge of 8 north western counties with the headquarters at Watertown. And we went to Pierre, the capital. Huron, I believe. Huron, I think, was where the center was. And the state president and organizations were there. And we had one field secretary who was sort of directing the rest of us. And there were, I think, National Association had sent about three or four others who had different sections of the state, and then reported to Huron and went in occasionally for conferring with the association person that they sent there, the head of the little group that was there. They had had about 5 or 6 suffrage campaigns in the state that they had lost. And this president was a very pleasant woman, but she was a large person who was not very mobile, and she would sit in the office and smile and say, well, of course, nobody is opposed to women's suffrage. You know, it was just obvious that she needed somebody to really direct the work and do it, and she was delighted to have that, too, but it was really very amusing. You couldn't get her going or get much out of her or get the things developed that needed to be developed passing the, getting the suffrage decided on.
And was your work in South Dakota essentially the same as it had been in New York?
Yes.
Organizing,
except it was much enlarged with 6 counties and much more territory to cover. And I would go to these places and try to start women's groups, you see, which was in a way educational work. Mm-hmm. That they had to do locally, and also to give them pointers and directions as to getting notices of it in the paper if they were having a meeting and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. the local paper, and all those different things to get the women helping with.
Now, there were not already existing groups the way there were in many
some
of the
New York
areas.
Some there were in some places, but mm-hmm. but we needed more, of mm-hmm. course.
And when, in terms of forming new groups in some of those areas, was the nucleus of those women from the women's club movement?
Well, there would usually be local women who would be rather leaders in the locality in various things, maybe in a church or maybe in a club or something like that. Maybe they'd ask you to come to speak to their club, and maybe they'd be leading and want to know what they could do, and we'd suggest that they call together a group of women to hear and talk about it, and they would know the women in the locality who would be interested, and some would be interested and active, and some would be uninformed and so forth. The National Suffrage Association had the policy of sending, at that time, I suppose earlier they'd done other things, of sending the field secretaries, paying for the field secretaries, you see, whereas some of the states thought they just give them the money, you see.
Oh, I see.
And then they gave them the money, and they didn't know how to develop the situation. Mm-hmm. So they made the policy of sending their own people out, you see, paying mm-hmm. their own people and offering them to the state, not giving the state money, which was a good policy. But some of the states didn't always like it too well.
So this way it was a more centralized
yes.
kind of structure, in other words.
Well, and it was sending people who probably, okay. yes, mm-hmm. knew a little bit better mm-hmm. how to work the thing up.
Now, you stayed in Dakota then till the election?
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. yes. And then we went back, I think.
The Dakota amendment was defeated in 1918, wasn't it? Passed finally in 1918?
No, it passed finally mm-hmm. that year. Yes, it passed that year. There was sort of a, you see, it was in wartime, and women were doing so much, and there was sort of a general, as you say, there's nothing that stops an idea when its time has come, in a way. It just sort of come then.
Now, by this time, Alice Paul's group had already begun picketing the White House.
And now,
how did
Paul,
you feel about those activities?
Alice Paul's group was a small group, but very vocal, you see, and made a lot of publicity. Alice Paul was a very capable person. She had been, she had worked in
Correct.
Mrs. Katz's organization, and had been chairman of the congressional committee. And she came back to one of the conventions and wanted to have the committee continued and have it given carte blanche for its own works, you see. And of course, no organization could do that without any control. And so she split off and went her own way with her group and got this publicity, which Mrs. Katz felt did more harm than good, really.
How did you feel about what the National Women's Party
well,
was doing?
Well, naturally, we felt, as Mrs. Katz felt, that they were doing more harm than good, because they were very sensational, and Mrs. Katz was trying for solid development, you see, so that the people would be back of it when it came. And that was the case, too, with the Federal Amendment. She was working all this time on the Federal Amendment. They didn't initiate the Federal Amendment. The Federal Amendment was first proposed way back in something like 1888,
or
long
70,
before that.
70,
18,
78, I think, maybe.
78, maybe it was. It was way back that that was first proposed. And that was, it was put in every year after that. And the first wording of it was changed later till it has now a much better wording than it did in the beginning. But I don't see that it's going to help much, because these things are social things. Of course, it's good to have any principle put into law, because that helps to pass it through. But you don't get these things for many years even afterward. Look, you've still got the Bakke case after, what is it, 20, 25 years. And the same thing with equal pay. We've had an equal pay law on the books, and you haven't got equal pay. And it just makes for a lot of litigation. And with all the money that has to be spent to get it through, it's not one of the things that I'm utterly enthusiastic about.
Well, in looking back, do you feel then that some of the suffrage work was a mistake, that it would have happened without all of that energy?
Oh, no. Not the type that the American Suffrage Association was doing. That was a sound, fundamental thing that was dealing with facts, you see. That wasn't trying to stir people up emotionally.
So the fact that there was kind of grassroots education in that
case,
made it better.
That's a grassroots education. That's a good way of putting it.
Now, after the Dakota campaign, then, where did you go?
Then I went to Virginia, and Virginia, of course, had had an equal suffrage league for some years, and had a very wonderful leader, Mrs. B.B. Valentine, of the suffrage league, and they were simply educating through the state at that time. And then in 1920, the legislative work to try to get the amendment ratified was what we were doing then, working with the legislature at that time.
Oh, so you worked in Virginia for 2 years then?
Yes, more or less. I was for brief times asked by the National Association to go to other states. So I had a brief time in West Virginia and in Tennessee and in North Carolina, and a little longer in North Carolina than in the others, and then would come back to the Virginia work, which was basically an educational type of work at that time, until 1920, when we were trying to get ratification. And we had some very strong supporters in the Senate, very excellent supporters in the Senate and House both, but Virginia didn't ratify. But there was a movement to positively turn it down, not just to not ratify, but to have a resolution that they did not want it, you see. And we did block that. They didn't succeed in getting that through. But and then I was asked to go to the university for the League of Women Voters was cooperating with the Extension Division at the university. The Extension Division was looking toward any types of things through the state that it could do to be helpful. They had a debating system through a series of debates through the high schools and a series of athletic contests and that type of thing, and anything with any group in the state. And there was a great deal of demand for information about public policies and measures and how do you vote anyway. And
was this directed primarily towards women then as part of the League's campaign?
Yes,
or was it a more general education campaign?
No, it was definitely having to do with public questions. Uh-huh. And of course, the women or men or anybody, but at that time the women were so anxious to have the information. And it was in cooperation with the League of Women Voters. And then every year we developed, every year after the first year or two, I don't remember, a 2-week citizenship institute at the university. I mean a week, mm-hmm. citizenship institute, and that was in cooperation with the League, and it was also in cooperation sometimes with other state agencies, like the welfare department, and it was an educational mm-hmm. thing. And of course my job was to arrange the program in consultation with the League, what they thought would be were the measures that were of particular interest in the state at the time, and to get the speakers. And they were also very cooperative. The state officials would come for us, and the professors at the university mm-hmm. would speak for us, and even some federal people came.
But were you basically employed by the university then, or by the League?
Oh no, this was by the university. Mm-hmm. It was just at instigation, in cooperation with the League. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the League helped ask speakers to come and that type of thing, mm-hmm. and help in suggesting things for the program and all of that. The League, many of the League members came to the institute.
What were your own plans at that point for the future?
Oh, I was working. I wasn't planning for anything more than doing this work mm-hmm. that I was doing then. Mm-hmm. And then I was there 5 or 6 years. Then I went to the University of Chicago for some more study.
Oh, you went to the University of Chicago too?
Yes, yeah. And I went to. I went one year to Geneva to study the League of Nations organization, and this all fitted in with my work at the university. And I went to the Institut Universitaire International for 6 weeks, which was studying the setup of the League and the policies and the principles. And we had a very fine leader who gave us while the League was in session, gave us a lecture on what had happened in the League before. He knew the personnel, he knew the meaning of the things that had happened and interpreted it. And he gave us a lecture at a certain hour in English and the next hour in French, mm-hmm. so we could get the two if we wanted to, and then we went to the session mm-hmm. and listened to the next day and so on and so forth.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the year at the University of Chicago? Were you in the economics department?
No, I was in the political science department with Professor Merriam, mm-hmm. who was a leading, outstanding political scientist in the country as a whole.
Well, did you have contact with all those women in Chicago, like Breckinridge and Abbott? And
oh, yes, uh-huh. of course. I had one of their courses in connection with it. With the other courses for the political science, and Dr. Wright, Quincy Wright in international relations, and Dr. White, who was management person, it was a very worthwhile. Mm-hmm. I was there for 4 quarters, longer than a year, a little longer mm-hmm. than a year.
Did you live in that residence hall where Breckinridge
and Abbott? Oh, yes, Green Hall. Yes,
so you had a lot of contact with them?
Oh, yes, with Miss Breckinridge, yes.
Well, was there quite a circle of women that would relate to it? The reason I'm so curious is since it turns out that Ethel also came out of the University of Chicago, and I've interviewed other women who have come out there,
there,
I wondered the extent to which
she was there
those
longer
women
than
had
I
influenced
was. All of you. I didn't. I had my master's degree before I went there.
Oh, where had you go? You'd gone back?
I got a master's degree at the University of Virginia.
Oh, while
you
were
there.
Working, I see.
I was one of the first women who got degrees there.
Oh.
One of the group.
So 1924. While you were working,
I was there in the summers, and then I would have classes in different cities in the winters. There were a lot of teachers who were, to renew their certificates, they had to take certain classes, and it was very helpful to them to have classes in their locality so they didn't have to come up to the university in the summer. And so some of them were some in the classes, and other people too, in the classes in the different cities.
And was that in political science on your master's?
Government, it was called government.
Oh.
Political science and government. Virginia
so
government.
When you went to the University of Chicago, was it with the intention of pursuing a doctorate?
Oh, that was political science. Yes, I was working on my doctorate and was admitted to candidacy for it. Finished all of the requirements, residence requirement and language requirements and so forth, except that I never finished my thesis. And I decided that I would have to have another quarter if I was going to finish that, and that it wasn't worth the money because women weren't getting any more. There was no it wasn't a great demand for women in political science teaching, you see, because everybody thought only men could teach political science. And our women, as they were graduating, one of our women who was very outstanding, getting her doctorate, she was offered a position in the state university for 1 year while the regular person was having his sabbatical.
And that, I'll tell you, that's still happening.
That type of